Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, because I'm in Lappeenranta in Finland. But I haven't got a Finn with me, I've got a Scottish person with me. I've got Cal Egan, who's a research fellow in the School of Computing at Edinburgh Napier University. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you indeed.
What brings you into Finland?
There's an ICT and sustainability thing going on here. A bunch of people that are doing computing and looking at sustainability, and I'm doing a very similar thing to that. And a lot of people here whose work I have read and have thought about and have quoted in my own works and stuff, and finally I've got to meet them. It's great.
Where did you grow up?
Where did I grow up? I grew up in Edinburgh. I'm an Edinburgher.
Is that what they're called?
It really is what they're called, yeah. Edinburgher.
What was it like growing up there?
Yeah, kind of idyllic in the early days, you know. It was nice, suburbia, before it all got really built up and everything. There were lots of fields around. We played freely, climbing trees. Not much computation, you know. Pong was about as computational as it got.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
An astronaut, of course. I'm of that age.
Has there been a Scottish astronaut?
Yeah. Who they are, I don't know, but there must have been.
There must have been, mustn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Scotty, of course.
So you're not an astronaut, I can tell.
No, I'm not an astronaut.
So what did you do instead?
I was never very good at science either, you know. I wasn't really that interested in science. Science fiction, I was, you know. So, what did I originally do? So I left school, and the first thing I did was set up a business, a sandwich business. Very entrepreneurial in the Thatcherite era. I was a kind of socialist with my own business with my friend Hammy, and we got a couple of baskets, and we got up really early in the morning, and we made sandwiches, and we took them around the offices.
Were they ham sandwiches?
There would have been a ham sandwich. I can't remember what. There would have been a cheese and a ham, and we might have done a tuna. That probably was about as exotic as it got at the time, you know. And I think we went to Cash and Carry and we bought some crisps. And we went round and it kind of worked for a bit. And we did it for, I don't know, a year maybe. Yeah.
And then that wasn't for you for the long term?
No, I think I went travelling and all that, you know, and worked in all kinds of jobs. And I was very, very interested in music. So I was always in bands. That was my passion, you know. So I did lots of bands, and then I went to college, and I think I did a diploma in radio and television production. That's the first sort of studies I did, vocational, applied. It was good, it was really, really good. A lot of people had done it, and they'd done very well. It was a nice course, hands-on, you know, so you got all those production skills and stuff. So I did that, and I worked in lots of community projects, kept playing in a band, kept going travelling. Kept wondering what the heck I wanted to do with my life, and then eventually I ended up back at as a mature student at university, 28 I think. I went back, did social sciences of all things. How does it happen, Sam? The meandering life.
Does it make sense in hindsight? I mean, is there a golden thread?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a thing. Well, the social science thing, I think there was always a love of history, you know. Always loved history, and I was kind of good at English. I was naturally good at English. I was naturally good at history and art and all those kinds of things. But I'd also, I guess, I'd lived a bit, and I'd sort of seen a bit of the world, and I wanted to know why things were this way. I think that's why I did the social science thing. I wanted the language. I wanted to be able to talk about it in a way that made sense, rather than just kind of getting angry about things. Well, how is this system being? What's going on here? You know, and so it was really good, and I excelled at it, because when you're a mature student, you know why you're there. You know, however, at the end of that, I was like, well, what am I going to do now? You know, I'm in my early 30s. I've got a degree in social sciences and a background in sort of media production and stuff. And at the time, it was a Labour government going on in the UK, and the Labour governments are generally pretty good for investing in science and tech. You know, historically, they're good in that respect. You know, so there was a master's programme at the university. This is at Napier as well, so I've spent a lot of time in Napier. There was a master's programme going there, and I think it was called Interactive Systems, Multimedia for Interactive Systems or something like that. And I thought, God, you know what, I could do that. All those analogue skills I'd got with video production and audio production and stuff, everybody was digitising them, and the government were paying for it. So not only did they pay for the course, but they gave you, I think you got a grant as well. I think there was a little bit of money, you know, $2,500 or something, you know, to come and do it. And funnily enough, a lot of people that I'd known over in the Edinburgh arts community and all that, it all ended up on this course, because it was like, hey, come and digitise your skills, become mm-hmm. part of the future. Yeah. You know? So we all ended up on this course, you know. And then that meant I worked out what I could do in that area. I worked out I wasn't a very good programmer. It really annoyed me. I worked out the limits to my knowledge. I think I thought you can learn anything, and then I did realise that no, you can't. You have a propensity for certain things and not other things. And however much I tried, couldn't get the programming. You know, I'd watch people just going, "Oh, you just do this." I'd be going, "What are you actually doing there?" You know. But I was very good at the creative aspect part of it, and the film and the video and all that was all absolutely fine. So that finished, I started my own little business, my own little web design business and all of that for a bit, because a few people said, it was all at that kind of time, you know, it was all changing. People want suddenly, people wanted one, and a website and all this. And when I was on the course, a few people.
Mid-late 90s, I'm guessing.
Early 2000s, mm-hmm. you know, early 2000s actually, you know, maybe 2001, something like that. So people had said to me during the course, "Oh, when you finish, can I have a website?" So I set up a little business, did that. But within 3 months of finishing that course, I was working in an agency. I got a job, you know. A pal had got a job, and he said, "Oh, you want to get Callan as well? He's good." And then that was me, kind of off, you know. And we spent, that was the coal phase. So I did like, I don't know, three or four years at the coalface designing websites, largely e-commerce websites, for small and medium-sized enterprises all over Scotland. Government-funded programme. That company got the contract, and we rolled out, travelling all over Scotland, doing the meeting clients, blah, blah, blah. I think I did maybe 200 websites in that period, you know. So, you know, like that.
Yeah. Because everybody needed it.
Everybody
go from
needed
not them. Having one to having
to
one.
To having one. I now have one, you know, and now I'm a part of the future and stuff like that. So, yeah, I did that for a bit. And that company folded eventually. They ran into some kind of financial difficulties and stuff like that. And the JP, the boss, wanted me to stay on and become their training manager and stuff, but I'd had enough. So I went back to set up my own company. And a lot of people, I wasn't pinching businesses, an ethical issue and all that there, but after 6 months, a few people from that area wanted to continue working with me, so I kept that going for a while. And then there was a crash about 2008. There was a financial crash and all that, and business seemed to get wasn't quite as good. So I thought, God, how am I going to pay the mortgage and look after the kids and all this sort of stuff? And then a position came up at Napier, two days a week, I think it was, just kind of being the media guy for research projects, European research projects. And I went along there to that interview, and I got on really well. I knew I'd got the job, you know. You can sort of tell. I don't think I'd got out of the campus, and I got a phone call saying, "Yeah, And I was like, yeah. So that was like, yeah, hooray. That's the mortgage paid those 2 days. You know, so I could yeah. do both things. I was like, that, great, fantastic. And then that work just spiraled into to 5 days a week eventually, because we ended up getting another project and the work, you know, workload got bigger and bigger, and did that for nearly 10 years. Yeah. And then that came to an end, and there was another abyss. You know what I mean? There's a pattern. There's a yeah. pattern of abysses in life, you know.
But there's also a pattern of things appearing on the other side.
Yeah, a luck, definitely. I've been spawny, as they say in Scotland, quite spawny. Serendipitous. I worked with a guy, I worked with a filmmaker ages ago, and his company was called Serendipity Films. And he, it's just funny. You know, at the time I thought, oh yeah, whatever, but he used to always go on about serendipity. Don't, just trust me, girl, serendipity. And it's sort of true, you know. As long as you enter into the world with a, you know, with a positivity or certainly a passion for things, that things seem to happen, you know. So luckily, and the next abyss, which was a tricky one, and in university structures, there's quite a lot of abysses can pop up. You know what I mean? You see people struggling, even here, talking to people, there's people having real dilemmas about their future mm-hmm. existence, you know, because it's quite precarious, you know. But this one was the most recent one, so just sort of 3 years ago, and I was like, oh no, what am I going to do? But I managed to, again, I scored a job as a senior designer in the research and innovation department, but only 3 days a week, yeah? So I was like, oh, right, that's kind of all right. We're not going to starve, but God, we're going to have to tighten the belt and everything a bit, you know? Maybe I can start the business up again and all that sort of stuff. But I got chatting to David Bennion, who's a professor of HCI, sadly died last year, you know, far too early. Great guy, David. I'd worked with him on other projects. His wife's an academic at the university as well, of English Lit, and we'd done this great project on Robert Louis Stevenson, the Scottish author, kidnapped Treasure Island and all that. And basically, we digitised all of his works and done a website for it. It was great. It was an awesome.
I love the backstory. I love the lighthouse story. I think it's even cooler than that.
Yeah.
Than his actual story.
Sure. Yeah. His story. I mean, his life. I mean, God, he was doing this before anybody, traveling the world, but as a bohemian, you know, one of the first in a sense. You know, I mean, quite astounding them on this ship. I mean, they went down your neck of the woods, and all that as well. You know, I don't know. I don't know if they got to New Zealand. Certainly Australia, and all those islands out in the Pacific and everything. Well, he died in Samoa, didn't he? He's buried on Samoa, you know. So that was a brilliant project, and that was David's wife, and so David was going to me, said, okay, well, why don't you do a PhD, Cal? I was like, I don't want to do a PhD. I've been working on my life. I've spent the last 10 years, you know, watching people chew their arms off in pain. I don't want it, but I thought, well, maybe this is it, serendipitously, maybe this is what I have to do, you know. So I started to look into, well, you know, what are you going to do in all this? And I thought, well, that's the problem with me, isn't it? What am I going to do? Because whatever I choose, I'm going to get bored. that's my nature of it, really, really quickly, you know. I don't want to specialise. I want to do something else. Yeah, and think, well, I want to think about it. And I'd always been into permaculture, the idea of permaculture. I'd find out about it about 20 years earlier. A friend had gone to university and had done a course, and he told me about it, and I got a book on it, and I loved this book, etc. And I always sat by my bed and all that, and always dipped into it. It was very positive, The Permaculture Garden by Graham Bell. And so I thought, okay, let's try this. David, what about permaculture? Shall we do interaction design in permaculture? I said, well, it's permaculture, and I explained it's a design framework, and he said, oh yeah, well, he was writing a chapter in his textbook on sustainability and interaction design and everything, so it's not that fitted. He was also a very keen gardener, you know. They had a beautiful garden in this Georgian townhouse in Edinburgh and everything, and so he just went for it and just started mucking around. Now, thankfully, so I read all the stuff, although everybody that's here, that's me reading all that blinking stuff. And I mean, it's hilarious how it all works, you know. But there was some funding kicking around in the department, and somebody had left, and he'd left this, I don't know, 20 grand lying around, something like that. And he said, I was only looking for 2 days a week, bear in mind. He goes, all right, I said, I don't want to do a PhD, really. And he goes, well, it's okay, there's a bit of funding here. We'll get you in as a research fellow, and we'll go from there. You know what I mean? I mean, I'd had lots of experience, not dissimilar to what we're doing here, Sam. You know, with research, I'd been all over the place with professors at a high level and everything. I'd done a master's and all that as well. I didn't really need to do a PhD. You know, I sort of had a PhD in my own brain. Like Hunter Thompson or something. Mm-hmm. I'll just name myself. I am a doctor. Yes. Okay, I say I'm a doctor. Okay, even if it's not legal or anything like that. So we had this money and we just got on with it. Started doing it. David is a great academic. He wrote an awful lot and was really well liked. Was very personable and everything. So it was a great connect. You know, whenever you went to an event with David, you met everybody. Everybody came up to David and shook his hand. And David was always dancing at the end of the night, and having a good time and all that sort of stuff. So just a really lovely character, a good guy. And he bought millions of pounds into the department on all kinds of research projects and stuff as well. So, we just started going for it and we just started designing some stuff. We got into augmented reality through a PhD student that was kicking around that David was looking after. And we started looking at gardens and augmented reality and went to a garden festival in Scotland and made this food forest exhibit, layers of the food forest, and we were sort of exhibiting, demonstrating how you could use the digital to show stuff that's going on in a space, by overlaying that space, that real space, using the camera on the phone, basically, and getting this layer of interaction over the top of it where you can start to kind of do things. And that was the sort of area that we were working in, Yeah, we just kept going from there, really. Wrote a couple of papers on that work. Went to designing interactive systems. That was quite good. We were always trying to be a little bit provocative. Like we would take our exhibit in, so we'd have a big plant pot in the middle. You go to quite a techie sort of place where it's all very clean, like that. So what I mean, which is that picture of the future that just doesn't ever happen anywhere apart from in a laboratory somewhere, but they do it at conferences a bit, and we would come in with a plant pot with bits of dirt falling off it. It would be so punky and sort of deliberately chained the technology to it, and it was all noisy and clunky, and it didn't work at all. And the kind of what we were saying, it was like, it would be nice if this stuff worked really well and it wasn't really irritating.
When it meets the real world.
Yeah, when it meets the real world, that it doesn't create any stress. And I think that was David's big thing as well. We were like, how do we do this in a way that's just sort of beautiful, in a way that's really lovely, that's really, what are the examples of this sort of stuff that works really well? And, it's, arguably maybe it is getting better, but it's still, let's face it, we're miles away from it being anything like a seamlessly wonderful experience. All this technology, it still kind of gets in the way of life, doesn't it?
So the name of the show and the research that I've been doing for over the last few years has been the concept of the sustainable lens. Mm-hmm. So probably the easiest person in the world to explain this to, mm-hmm. you put on the augmented reality goggles, mm-hmm. you turn it to sustainability mode, mm-hmm. what do you see when you're looking out? How does that change? What are you adding?
Sure.
In that sustainability mode. So what do you see in your sustainability mode?
What do I see in my sustainable? Well, I always just thought that, I think it's kind of, well, actually, as an interface, you mean, what's actually physically in that space, or just,
what are we adding in the augmented reality space?
We're adding, and I'm not sure what the modality of it would be, I think we're still messing around with that, whether it's video or sound or graphics or something else, or touch, or, we're still not completely sure, but what I do know is that there's a load of stuff out there in nature that knowledge that we had, astonishing lore that people would have when they lived out of the city, go back a couple of hundred years, everybody would have, And you would know what all the plants and everything were, for example. And I don't know that. And I know you can learn it without technology and you can just go and do it and everything. But, you know, to me it would be interesting to still know and to know more because, we have advanced, evolutionarily and all that as well. We do know more about it as well. Identification, recognition of things, I'm very interested in that. And then I guess I'm also interested in the relationships between the things that are in that landscape as well, and knowing all about them. The stuff and the hidden, the stuff that you can't see, which is really the engine of the whole thing. And that's still, it's a big area, you know, what's going on under the ground and what do we have to do? We have to enrich that. I mean, that's really under pressure as well. You know, all this landscape, this world is really, really suffering at the moment. So we need to understand it to some extent so we can save it, you know, as well, I think. And to do that, the more people that know how it operates and can replicate it as well. So that's another part of what we're doing. It's an information system, I guess, to show people how to build abundance using technology, you know. That seems to me quite a useful thing to do. And along the way, I guess, the way I think about it, is that if, like the project that I've got in Napier, which is putting in permaculture gardens, I guess I think that the side product, even if the tech doesn't work, we've helped the world out. We've created biodiversity anyway. So you could, you know what I mean? If the tech thing becomes a dead end in some way, we've got a whole lot of people outside, away from tech. We might have improved their health and well-being a bit. We might have improved their lives a little bit. You know, they might be cooking more organic veg, and there are more bees and birds and other things that are happy in an urban setting, which is really, fairly greenless. Yeah, I mean, Edinburgh is actually a very green place, you know, so we're kind of lucky.
But your campus is a mix of a 60s concrete block and bits of old building.
Yeah, bits of old building. And it's a dead zone as well. So, I mean, what I'm doing in some respects in terms of the actual space is making a wildlife corridor from a bit where there is life and biodiversity over that side, and there is over this side, but then they plonk the university down and just basically killed everything in the process, you know. So it's just, and if that's all it is, I could live with that, to tell you the truth, you know what I mean? I wouldn't go, God, this has been a failure. We're going, no, look at that, that's amazing, look how beautiful that is. I mean, and it's, but I think we've got people with this technology and everything. So we're computationalizing the spaces because people have all this stuff on them, you know, anyway, and they want to use it, and they've always taken it out of their blooming pockets and everything. You know, me too. You know, can we, rather than it just being, you know, scrolling through everything like that, can we do something in there? Can we get their attention and then do something? And then I guess that's the other part. It's like, can we provoke them to action in some way? Not easy to do any of this stuff. All very, very difficult, you know. I want to have a go. I want to make the knowledge that I've got in this area, I want to apply it in the sustainable domain. And that's definitely where I am suited to work, you know what I mean?
So it's an actual garden?
It's an actual garden.
Growing plants, real growing plants, not augmented plants.
See
that concrete thing?
One.
Just put these glasses on.
Sure, well, students have done that sort of stuff. Of course they have. That's absolutely fine. Why not? Mm-hmm. I'm not dictating. Well, that's the other thing, Sam. I am not dictating. I am putting in the infrastructure. We have put in a polytunnel. We have put in a little food forest. We have got other little planting schemes we're going to do. We have put in a rooftop allotment, and, you know. But really, and then, you know, the little ponds and stuff like that. But really, I'm saying to people, come hither and into the space, regardless of your domain, and do sustainability in it. Apply it. See if you can do it here in a real world setting. You know, and it seems to be working. Yeah.
Are you getting people from across the university into your space?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely not. Obviously, I work in the School of Computing, so it's quite easy for me to bring those students in. I'm working with creative industries as well. They're really into it as well, product designers. They seem to be really into it. We've had applied sciences down. We've had occupational therapists. We've had soil scientists. We've had a lot of people from professional services as well. And we go outside of the university too. So a bit, another big point is thing that we're trying to do in the domain of university. I mean, it's quite, universities are places within communities, etc. We want to make the gardens an interface with the community as well. That's really important. And they are, we're going to be a bit standoffish. I think our university has got a bit of a reputation of not engaging that much. So it's got a gate. It's called the Lion's Gate. There's a 16th century gate there. You wouldn't believe how difficult it is for me to get them to open this gate. Without this alarm going off, can you just put a switch in there, switch the alarm off, and then we can open the gate and then people can come in and just talk to us. We have a gate, an actual interface with the public, and I'm fairly sure that in the coming months that's going to open up, and we're going to try and open up the university to the communities that are around us and bring them in and make universities really open places, places that people want to come in and spend time in, and maybe they'll come and learn something, not just what I'm doing, but loads of other things,
One of the principles of permaculture is about the understanding of the place.
Yeah.
And it's actually got a really interesting place because of the name, in the name, the Napier.
Sure.
So yeah. It's where Napier lived.
The mathematician, the inventor of logarithms, John Napier, lived in the tower. It's amazing, yeah. I mean, when we've been digging the garden up, I guess you have an idea. I mean, it was used for all kinds of military processes over the years and all that. So we found bits of cannonballs in that when we've been doing it. So it's been used. I can't remember what the history is. I think Charles II, sort of time, or it might have been Cromwell or something like that. It would have been commandeered.
Can I just take a little bit of a step back?
Yeah.
It's not so much the pivot, but the bringing together the two sort of ideas. You'd had a long interest in permaculture and a history through media, eventually forming that into interaction.
Yep.
What brought those together? What was the thought processes to bring them together?
The media, the interaction design, and the
permaculture.
And the permaculture. I, in all honesty, I think I've been looking at the background of interaction design and all of that for a while, and I hadn't liked a lot of it. I just think some of it. I just got bored of it. Your user experience. I just find it all. Really, is that all it is? Yeah. And I just find it. I just thought, oh God, not another talk about this. You know what I mean? Just the cycle of design. That's how I felt about it, and then I found permaculture, and I didn't really know from Graham Bell's book, The Permaculture Garden, that I got. There wasn't any talk of a kind of principles or anything like that, or anything like that. It wasn't in there at that point. I don't think they'd been developed in the 90s. But when I went back into it and I discovered that David Holmgren had done this principle thing, and I looked at it and I was like, whoa. There's a mapping of these to that as a design. This is just a design process, but they're chucking in stuff about energy use. They're chucking in stuff about renewables, but then there's stuff about boundaries and edges. And I was like, well, that's there. That's the good bit. Those are the bits of the interaction design that I kind of liked. The more art kind of aspects of it. But I had all that care of the planet. Things that it was funny. I was speaking to Curtis, one of the other guys that's here. We were talking about when we were on the cruise on the lake and all that yesterday, and we were talking about how when we were little, how our dads dragged us out onto, and it was the same thing, onto rivers to fish, and how you would No, you know, you'd be, at the time, you did enjoy it, but it became something, not another raincoat on sand, but really it's just my dad fishing and your son sit down there and don't talk to me, probably, you know. But actually what that did was, you know, that's where the love of nature came from, you know. And I just wanted to bring that into my work because I know that it made me happy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's as simple as that. And then of course, serendipitously, things come up as well. Then this health and well-being, this sudden focus on health and well-being comes into sort of the academic research and stuff, and or becomes just a thing in society. And I'm doing gardens, and it's like, well, and everyone's saying, well, gardens are great places for health and well-being. And I'm going, yeah, aren't they? Yeah. I can say that as many times as you like, yeah. I can drive that point home.
So what could computing learn from permaculture, sustainability?
What can it learn? It can learn, certainly computing design can learn. I mean, you brought up space, about this knowledge of space, and it's in there anyway. Paul Dourish and all these guys, they've done those brilliant, brilliant papers as well, you know. I mean, that's great work, you know. Understanding of space and stuff like that. It's a big thing with permaculture. I think it can bring... I think there's a real need to slow down in some respects. In terms of climate change, there's a need to speed up and do things very, very quickly. But in terms of processes about product development and stuff like that, I think they probably go too fast. And I don't really like the model. I'm not a massive fan of an agile model. I'm not a massive fan of continually updating things and redundant code and all, and the update, I find it really very irritating, you know. And I just think it could be done better, and it's all about money, and I don't really like it. I question it as a, and it may well be the root of a lot of the anxiety, information anxiety that people feel today, and I certainly felt it. Feel plugged in far too much. So what can it bring into it? It can make it more thoughtful, maybe. It can make us think about the components that we're developing and that we're making, and what they're made of, and where they come from, and what the social relations are behind those components, and it makes you think about the whole, you know what I mean? You have to, permaculture will make you strip the thing back to its reality, I suppose, you know. Other things can do that as well, but permaculture can do that, but then it can also do, but you know, it can also suggest if you're getting stressed out about that and it's making you anxious in any way, just go out and plant some garlic or pick some fruit, or you know what I mean, or just do something else, you know what I mean? You don't have to. I like the broadness. I think that, I mean, I've not really mm-hmm. thought about it, Sam. I'm thinking, I'm off the top of my head, but it forces you to go, you know, it doesn't force you, but you just go, oh, I'm not doing this anymore. There's something about this, whatever I'm doing, and I don't like it, I'm just going to go and do something else. And a lot of the time it'll involve me just going outside, yeah, and refocusing it in a sense, you know. And I just think that's a really healthy thing to do.
I think there's something in the notion of you're not growing plants or growing for food, you're building the earth.
Yeah.
It's that earth building notion, and I
sure.
think that computing and the wider sciences could learn a lot from that. Mm. It's almost that bigger picture, it's that slower,
yeah.
This is, you know, just do whatever you like, but if we're not increasing the health of the earth,
sure.
The soil in this case.
Yeah.
And I think if we can take that to, okay, so you're making this thing more efficient, but how is that actually helping that bigger, slower picture?
Yeah, exactly.
I think we're missing those.
Definitely.
Those things.
Yeah, and you probably could wait around and do all the stats on that, huh? You probably could do that. But really, just go and do it, you know what I mean? Just go and actually improve the soil for a bit and then come back in. You can still be a software programmer. And let's face it, these guys are. Most of them seem to be into it anyway. They get it. You're kind of, you know, you're not having to, there's no preaching going on here. I think a lot of software engineers are this way inclined in many ways. You know, they get wired into things too much. But there's I think that's always been there around computing.
I think another thing is thinking off the top of my head. There's another thing about the reality of the garden.
Yeah.
The reality of the messiness of the garden. The reality, yes. And in fact, the messiness is probably healthier.
Yeah.
And we're too keen to go for some homogenous, bringing everything down to just the system.
Sure. Agreed. Absolutely.
We need that.
Yeah. I love the messiness of it. I think mess is a great area. It's an area I want to get more into, you know, just the messiness of it all, the reality of it. I mean, you know, you've had kids as well, you know. It's a messy world, you know. This computer's covered in sick. Yeah. There's a dirty nappy lying next to it, maybe. You know what I mean? And everything's all a spaghetti of leads, right? That's the way it is, you know. And, you know, the marketing of it is so ridiculous in many ways, you know. The machines have become... They're still just... Computer. I just find it all quite confusing what they're. I don't believe that it's going to solve all of our problems at all. To me, they're just another tool, and they have to become like a tool in a toolkit. If this is the tool that I need in order to do what I do, then that's the one I'll do. But it might just be a hammer, or it might be a sewing kit or something. I don't, you know what I mean?
So, what are your plans for the garden?
Well, the plans are to get the university to really back it, and there seems to be a lot of positive work in that area at the moment. You know, there's a vibe going on in the university around climate change and everything as well. Actually, when I've been here, there's been a big meeting I see that they've had. So we want to... The plans are to get the infrastructure done to such an extent that it's a self-sustaining system. We're not far away from that, you know. We need to get the water features in and a little bit more planting, and then they're already taking care of themselves to some extent. Yeah, so the circular food thing is a big one. So that would be a nice one, and it's kind of going already, and that's happened just very in a grassroots manner. The kitchens love the garden, and they use the space. I didn't expect that at all. They just kind of, all the catering staff are like, we've got a garden, and it's so cool, you know what I mean? They love it, and they're so nice to me about it, and they get all the food, and I'm always like, just take what you want when you want it. And, you know, it's created a really positive thing. But then we obviously, what we're going forward, that just making that whole thing work, are we going to use some kind of ordering system and all that kind of stuff? There's lots of great little work, all student projects. I would give students little nudges and say, look, we've got this element of the garden. You know, and we've got, you know, students that really are into the whole pond environment, the ecosystem of ponds and stuff like that, and the health of them in an urban setting. You know, there's another project there. And then, you know, we've got a stage, we're going to do performance, it's going to be a fringe venue. We've got this chair, the interactive throne, which is going to be computationalized and kind of have a personality, and it's going to go searching for articles about sustainability, and it's going to go searching for people to raconteurs to invite to sit in the chair and tell stories in the chair in the garden of a sustainability or nature-based kind of theme, you know. So we're just trying to bring people into the spaces as much as we possibly can. We've got food forests, we've got a medicinal herb garden going on, we've got tea gardens going in, sensory gardens. We want to make it accessible for wheelchairs and all this kind of stuff as well. We've got that whole element of it too. And so lots of events will go on in the spaces. I think we've already had a couple already that have gone dead well. We've got an outdoor pizza oven, somebody else bought it. So we just have that come in, sit in the garden and we'll pick all the stuff. And then, you know what I mean? It's a kind of, you can't, you know, we're going to make a Napier jam, you know, a Napier chutney. We've got juniper bushes. Are we going to make a Napier gin? You know what I mean? It's really where you want to go with it, you know. And really, of course, in my mind, I want the universities to buy this facility that's for sale down in the borders on the banks of the Tweed and become a world centre for sustainability. That's what I would like them to do, but, you know, whether we ever get there, we'll have to see, you know. They would really have to grab the nettle.
So you've got backing from the university hierarchy?
At present, I have. To some extent, I have bods in the university that have my back. And I've become very upfront about it now, and I think in light of everything that's going on with climate change and the fairly depressing state that the world is in, I've decided to just be a very, very vocal person within the structure of the university about that. And I'm now talking to the leadership. I've put my concerns into emails to the leadership team, saying, when they're talking about their strategy and stuff like that, that they really have to put this stuff into their strategy, into the sustainability, quite centrally, in my view, utterly central, going forward, and that they will benefit enormously from it if they do that going forward.
One of the advantages of a garden is it's like you've got to walk past it to get into the building.
Sure,
it's in the face.
It's in your face, yeah.
And I think one of the big things is that it's brought sustainability from the back of house.
Yeah,
and as we were talking about before, the things you can't see.
Yeah.
To, well, here's the stuff.
Yeah.
Have you got composting on site?
Yeah, got composting on site. We've got composters there. We did a little thing with coffee. I mean, we've got a couple of cafes on the campus, and so I went to them and I said, oh, can we have your coffee granules? Move your coffee granules, and we'll compost that as well. Oh, yeah, great. So they started, I think it was 4 days or something, they collected the coffee granules, and I think we got a fifth of a ton. In 4 days. So it was like, actually we can't deal with that capacity. So we just stopped, but it's that kind of thing. We're just looking at the system.
But then that opens up more challenges about
We had a French guy come in going, oh yeah, you can grow mushrooms on this coffee granule. And people don't have this knowledge, and this is the whole thing. And another great thing about permaculture is that nobody pertains to know it all at all. It's a collective knowledge sort of thing. You open up the space, you talk about it, and you're inviting people in with their own ideas. I am not dictating what is going on in these spaces other than a basic sort of infrastructure. Then it's up to the students and the people that come into it to bring themselves into the space, because that otherwise it's just no point really. I don't think you can force people to do anything, but you can ask them to think about it, from their perspective. And I just think that that's a better way of doing it. Yeah, they'll hate it, maybe they'll do something really punky about destroying it or something. I don't really care if it's provocative in some way. It's interesting if it's provoked people to then it's winning. I want it to be that kind of thing. I want it to be dangerous to some extent. We've talked about this chair, interactive chair, just being really grumpy and all that, having a grumpy mode and a kind of happy mode, somewhere in between, just getting and being sort of horrible sometimes. If the pollution in the city is really bad, then it would lock the doors. It wouldn't let anybody into the garden or something. It would go on strike almost.
Do you have detractors?
Yeah, I think, somebody said something at the ULT, the leadership team over there, said that they'd been trying to get, that there were people that were wanting to get sustainability there, but there'd been pushback. Yeah, there are detractors, yeah, definitely. And they are gatekeepers as well, those detractors, so that they are the problem with it.
In your case, the literal gatekeepers.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, you couldn't make it up.
It's got a nice logo. Because it's called Lion's Gate.
The Lion's Gate, yeah, and I kind of like that. We were going to try and make it even more. We were trying to make it quite sort of Rasta. That was my thing originally. I was like, yeah, we've got lions, something proud, and in order to the strength of it, I like the strength of the lion, and I haven't really talked about that to anybody in the university yet, but that's kind of my thinking behind it. It's like, come on, it's a lion, you've got to rise to the challenge, you've got to be big, we've got to be big and strong to do this, we've got to be proud, and whatever other attributes a lion has,
It's interesting, the mix of the calmness of the garden, a place of retreat,
yeah,
and wanting it to be provocative and dangerous at the same time.
Sure.
Yeah. That's art space, huh? I mean, you start working with artists, yeah. and it's great, though, you know, you just, because that, yeah, okay, so a lot of time the artists are the detractors, too. I love it, you know what I mean? They just push back and they go, sustainability, a lot of rubbish, you know what I mean? And they're just provoking you all the time, you know. I mean, you know that they actually generally, not completely, but generally they are believers, too, or they're certainly interested in it, but they ask all the right questions. They're not afraid, and they can express themselves in a manner that maybe you're I'm not going to say bog standard, although, you know, you're gigging academic, sometimes we'll get lost in words, whereas an artist will come along and a couple of strokes of a pen will convey it, the thing, you know, more clearly.
We introduced you as a research fellow, but that's a job title. What do you use to describe your framework?
I don't know. I'm not big on titles. I don't want to over-categorize it. I'm a musician as well, and we did this. I can't believe I'm saying this on this, but there was a line that somebody said way back in the 60s, and it was on some documentary film that our band had watched, and we always really liked it, and I'm not going to remember it now that I've talked about it. And it goes, I might still have it, and it's some guy, you know, a far-out guy from the 60s, and he's going, I think it's to Michael Parkinson, the chat show host, the UK chat show host, and he goes, if we name it, we limit it, and if we limit it, we lose it, because by its very nature, it is unlimited. Yeah.
You got it out.
I got it out. I haven't forgot. Come on, that's going back 20-odd years, you know, it has lodged in. And I always like that. I mean, there might be a load of nonsense. That might mean nothing. That could just be some kind of Zen koan or something like that actually has no basis, if you were to take it apart logically. But I don't. We don't need to do it. Somebody, my brother-in-law, my brother-in-law and a friend of mine is very high up in the bank. He went into the bank when he was 17, and he just stayed there, and he's absolutely minted and everything, you know. And they both said to me, "You're a thought leader, Cal." I wasn't provoking. I wasn't asking them what I was, but that's how they. And it was funny to me. And they've said that recently, and I was like, "Okay, is that what I am? I don't know." I don't know.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
I don't like the word sustainability. It's not there. I don't know. I can't do it, Sam. I don't like the word sustainability because it's been hijacked, and I don't like it being hijacked just to mean something that survives into the future, you know, largely a business process,
a
company.
The next business cycle.
Yeah, the next business cycle, and you know, and it's utterly meaningless. So I had a big thing, when I put the project together, the university had three research themes, yeah, that were supposed to kind of guide all work. One of them was, I've got to try to remember these now as well. What am I doing to myself here? Sustainable communities, information society, health and well-being. Yeah. And David's goal was to put the meat onto those three terms, you know, because they just don't mean anything. So we said, right, we're going to make those things mean something rather than just be words, phrases that you can bandy around in a tick-boxy kind of way.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I think just persuading the university at the time to go with it. That was too easy. We couldn't believe it. I mean, that was the first. we just the first place we went, and then it just was like, yeah. We didn't have to work for that really at all, you know. It was remarkable.
Sometimes the barriers turn out to be imaginary barriers.
Sure, definitely. I was saying this to somebody the other day, that I think it was to Oliver. It's like, just don't be afraid to ask. That's the secret. Don't be afraid to ask. There is no hierarchy. Yeah.
Is there a guerrilla element of what you're doing?
We've tried it, and I think if things carry on the way they are at the moment, there's no doubt that it will become quite intensive. just out of need as much as anything. It's just preposterous. You can get tangled up in all kinds of committees and all this sort of stuff. And it's nice. I like the democracy of it all. I'm very happy with. But sometimes you just got to go straight to it and just say this is nonsense. What we're trying to do here, we're trying to plant a couple of flowers over there. We don't have to go committee for this. Just need to put them in on the way home from work. Throw them in. You know.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yeah, definitely. Now, yeah. I think I'll die an activist now. Yeah, for sure.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I'm lucky. I'm a half, a glass half full kind of person. I love life, you know. I can go out into my garden at home and I can sit down with a cup of coffee on the step. And I can go, life is good.
Yeah. You're managing to keep your own garden going?
It's a bit wilder. I think the grass will be about 6 inches high when I get back. But yeah, I have my own little permaculture thing going on in the back garden, you know. And I love it. And it's actually, been an awful season, actually. It's been an awful summer, but the garden's looking fab. I've got plums on my plum tree for the first time, and loads of them, and I really can't wait for them to get ripe. And yeah.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
I want to write more. I want to have the space to write it down. In a story, I want to get the story out, and I want it to be kind of an inspiring text, just an honest text. You know, I mean, I really want to write. I want to improve my writing. I want to write like Hunter Thompson and Ernest Hemingway about this stuff. I want it to be clear and unambiguous, and just go straight to the soul of people. You know.
Two more questions. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
I don't know. Less suffering.
I'll let you over that one. If you came up with something that was too vague, I have a follow-up question, is what can we do about it?
More kindness in the world, you know what I mean? Just people being kinder. More open heart, you know, and people being more open and more kind to ideas. I don't know what happens to people. At some point, they just seem to take on ideas. I don't think even they know where they've come from.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yeah, go just plant the seed. get some seeds. And plant them and grow them, and just, you know what I mean, take over your neighbourhood, throw them into the wherever there's a plot of land, grow, plant trees, you know, follow your heart, your intuition.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Sam. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. I have been talking with Cal Egan, a research fellow at the School of Computing. Each week we talk with somebody making a positive difference and try to see the world through their perspective, through their sustainable lens. And I think I'm going to have to go and visit Edinburgh Napier University.
You will be most welcome.
You can find Sustainable Lens on sustainablelens.org and all the other potty sorts of places, and we are broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.